House comes to oral questions. Question number one in the name of Greg O'Connor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Building and Construction. What recent reports has he received on competition in the market for residential building supplies?
The Honourable Megan Woods.
Mr. Speaker, kia ora. This morning, the Commerce Commission released their draft market study into residential building supplies. The report indicates New Zealanders are not getting a fair deal on some key residential building supplies. While the government has already driven improvements in the sector, the Commerce Commission's draft review finds that changes are needed to make it more competitive. The Commission has pointed to a few areas of specific concern that may be impeding competition, including the building regulatory system, the use of quantity forcing rebates by building suppliers, and restrictive land covenants. The report ties in very well with both the plasterboard task force work and the building consent system review currently underway to modernise the system by ensuring it is faster, more efficient and flexible.
Supplementary question. Why did the government ask for this market study from the Commerce Commission?
Mr. Speaker, we asked the Commerce Commission to undertake the market study because of long-standing concerns about potential competition issues, and the draft report confirms there are issues that need to be addressed and explored further. With warm, dry, affordable housing underpinning so many other social, economic and health outcomes, and given population growth and an increase in building consents over the last decade to over 50,000 houses per year, it's vital consumers get the best deal. We had a sense that there was work to be done to improve competition and outcomes for New Zealanders, and that's why we committed to delivering this building supplies market study as a key Labor Party manifesto commitment.
Before the next supplementary, that was actually enough answer for two questions, but a bit more concise.
Further supplementary question. What is the remaining process for the Commerce Commission's market study into the residential building supplies?
Mr. Speaker, the process from here is the Commission will be seeking feedback on those preliminary recommendations, and I encourage everybody to input into the process via the ComCom's website. Consultation on the draft report is open for 4 weeks and closes on Thursday the 1st of September. The Commission's final report will be released by 6 December 2022 with final recommendations informed by the consultation process. The Government will then consider those final recommendations.
Question number two in the name of Nicola Willis.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Revenue and asks, can he confirm that the reason overseas New Zealanders have received the cost of living payment is that the Inland Revenue Department has a New Zealand address for that taxpayer rather than an overseas one? If so, how many people does he estimate fail to change their address with Inland Revenue when they leave the country?
Mr. Speaker. The Honourable David Parker.
Mr. Speaker, at the risk of putting Herald political editor Claire Trevett to sleep, yes, the eligibility assessment for presence in New Zealand is based on the principal physical address held by Inland Revenue for an individual taxpayer. And to the second part of the question, there is no requirement to gain tax clearance when a person leaves New Zealand. Inland Revenue does not know the number of people who don't change their address when they leave New Zealand.
Well, in light of that answer, isn't it potentially the case that hundreds of thousands of temporary migrants and New Zealanders have left the country without updating their address details with IRD, and therefore hundreds of thousands of people have received the cost of living payment in error?
Mr. Speaker, as I have said on a number of occasions, we'll never know the exact number of people who were paid the payment. We do know that the New Zealand tax data is very robust. I have personally said I think the number of the number of wrong payments will be around 1%. And I have repeatedly said to the House, which I think is correct, that the alternative application system for 2 million people would have cost a lot more than the money saved. The 1.3 million people who received a cost of living payment this week would not have received it, and the policy is better than the alternatives of tax cuts for CEOs and overseas landlords.
Will New Zealanders ever know how many ineligible people living overseas have been paid the cost of living payment? Or is it the government's position that they should instead rely on the wishful thinking of a minister who freely admits his numbers are picked from the sky?
As I have also repeatedly said, Mr. Speaker, Inland Revenue increasingly rely upon sophisticated software to automate previously manual transactions. This saves the government and taxpayers millions and millions of dollars every year on administration and has cut staff numbers at Inland Revenue by about 2,000 people. The benefits to taxpayers include automated assessments and refunds and other payments worth hundreds of millions of dollars every year. The use of automated data sets, which we continually strive to improve, is wise, saves money and will continue, and I will add, is what was used throughout for COVID support payments.
Well, isn't it the case that despite sophisticated data systems, at the heart of his government's cost of living payment policy is a fatal flaw, that it rested on the assumption that New Zealanders ring the IRD to change their address when they leave the country?
In answer to the first part of the question, no, and it's plainly no.
Can he be confident that no deceased people have been paid the cost of living payment?
Mr. Speaker, in response to that, I would quote James K. Baxter. Alone we are born and die alone, yet see the red gold cirrus over snow mountains shine. Upon the upland road, ride easy, stranger. Surrender to the sky your heart of anger. In other words, after someone has died, they can't update their details to Inland Revenue. What Inland Revenue relies upon is periodic information that comes through from Internal Affairs, which is itself imperfect, but the best that the country has.
How many deceased people have been paid the cost of living payment?
Probably around the same number of as deceased people who get super deceased people bank accounts that get superannuation or unemployment or other payments or perhaps even National Party pamphlets after they die.
Has he sought advice on how many prisoners have been paid the cost of living payment despite being ineligible?
No, I haven't, and I haven't received a report as to any. They are ineligible to receive the payment.
Is he concerned that intentional misinformation has been spread about the number of people who have been paid the cost of living payment, including by the Labor Party, in a fundraising email which stated that more than 2 million people had received the payment?
I have no ministerial responsibility for that email.
Question number three, in the name of Camilla Balich.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Education. What support has the government contributed to help schools to provide learning environments for their students that are warm, dry and fit for purpose?
Mr. Speaker, since 2018, the government's committed $3.8 billion in new capital funding to improve school property up and down the country. That includes funding for the National Education Growth Plan to build new schools and classrooms to keep up with the growing population, the National School Redevelopment Program to address the very poor condition some school buildings were in when we inherited them, and the School Investment Program, which provided funding to nearly every state school in New Zealand to bring forward and complete much-needed property projects. To provide a comparison, over $5.7 billion has been spent on upgrading and expanding school properties between 2018 and 2022, compared to $2.9 billion in the 5 years preceding that.
Supplementary. How many property projects managed by the Ministry of Education are currently being undertaken across New Zealand?
Mr. Speaker, heaps. As of August, there are 313 Ministry of Education-led property projects in construction across New Zealand. That includes 77 learning support property modifications, 9 new schools, 8 new school expansions, 124 redevelopments, 38 redevelopments that also involve role growth projects, and 57 role growth projects. We've invested in the capability of the Ministry of Education to manage these projects, and as a result, schools up and down the country are getting a better deal and better property as a result.
Very good. Very good.
What has been delivered in terms of redevelopments and additional student places from the spending?
Mr. Speaker, when we became the government, we had a serious issue with school overcrowding in some areas because the investment in capital had not kept up with the role growth. Through the National Education Growth Plan, 27,298 additional student places have already been delivered through the building of schools and classrooms, and that's running through until that's as of June of this year. 1,926 of those were delivered in the last quarter alone. The highlight, one of the highlights, was the opening of the new Scott Point School in Auckland for 650 students. That was funded in Budget 2018. Since 2019, we've fully completed 62 major redevelopment projects worth over $460 million. Around half of these were in the last year. We are making really good progress in making sure that schools have the classrooms they need and they have the facilities they need to provide kids with the education they deserve.
Question number 4, in the name of the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Justice. Does she stand by all her statements and policies?
Mr. Speaker, yes. In particular, by the package.
I didn't realise you were on Zoom. Sorry about that. The Honourable Kiritapu Allen.
Mr. Speaker, yes, in particular, I stand by the package of measures Minister Hipkins and I announced on 13 July to help reduce the harm caused by gangs and make communities safer, which included a targeted new warrant and additional search powers to find and seize weapons from gang members during a gang conflict, expanding the range of offences where police can seize and impound cars, motorbikes and other vehicles, a new offence of discharging a gun with intent to intimidate, the ability for police and other enforcement agencies to seize cash over $10,000 when found in suspicious circumstances, and the expansion of the list of high-value goods prohibited for sale for cash over a specified value to include watches, jewellery, precious metals and stones, motor vehicles and boats.
Supplementary. Mr. Speaker, does her statement on Tuesday that it's not contradictory to believe equal voting rights are critically fundamental to New Zealand's democracy, while at the same time supporting the Canterbury Regional Council Ngāi Tahu Representation Bill, mean that in her view, Cantabrians will still have equal voting rights after the Act takes effect?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I do stand by that statement, sir.
Will Cantabrians have equal voting rights after the Canterbury Regional Council Ngāi Tahu Representation Act takes effect?
Yes, sir. Cantabrians do retain equal voting rights, and as the former national government showed to us, both in 2010 and again in 2016, when they established the position for Ngāi Tahu to be appointed to ECAN, this bill continues with that practice.
When she said this week, quote, "I think we have to keep things in perspective. It feels like there is more crime. I think it's being reported more. I think there is a bit of a spike. I don't think it's a trend," end quote. Does it mean she thinks shopkeepers like Harry Luther of Hamilton are just reporting crime more, and what they are actually experiencing is a reduction in youth crime?
I think that people like Mr. Tam are experiencing an increased level of crime. There is that spike that we've been mentioning, and it's been very concerning for all of us. Hence the measures that myself and Minister Hipkins announced earlier this month or last month with respect to the powers that we're providing to police. Hence the targeted package that we are providing to those shop owners that have been impacted and targeted by youth ram raids. Sir, it is an issue for all of us on our side of the government. We continue to be focused on how we can eliminate or reduce radically any of the trends in these spikes in crime.
Regarding your statement in the electoral amendment bill debate, quote, 70% of respondents of a recent Victoria University Wellington survey indicated that they did not trust the political funding framework, end quote. Does she think it's building trust in the funding framework for a party to send an email stating that an inflation payment of $116 was going to 2 million people while asking for a donation of $10?
Whilst I have no ministerial responsibilities for any political party's statements, what I do think, sir, is that closing any gaps that relate to political party donations and electoral law reform is something that we're committed to, and it's something that we are cracking on with. I think that enabling greater transparency for political party donations to all parties is something that New Zealanders have sought. It's something that the Labour Party in our manifesto, we went out to the electorate and sought that mandate. An overwhelming majority of New Zealanders supported us to crack down on political party donations, sir. So it's measures like that that our side of the House is committed to increasing that trust and transparency for all New Zealanders in our democratic system.
Mr. Speaker.
Point of order, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Mr. Speaker, I seek leave to table an email from the Labour Party saying that $116 had gone to 2 million people and asking for $10.
Can I ask who the email is to? And if they have given
consent? No, they haven't given consent.
Have they given consent?
It's been given to multiple people. I could give you many examples. Some have actually asked for $150.
I just want one.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Thank you. Leave has been sought for that purpose. Point of order, the Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, the email has been published by the media. There are clear rulings. I mean, I have no problem with it being tabled, but there are rulings that suggest that stuff that's freely available in the media shouldn't be tabled, and it's disorderly to attempt to do so.
Chris Bishop.
Well, the interesting thing is there are multiple versions of the email, sir. So some people have received emails asking for $10. Other people have received emails asking for $20, $30, $40, $50. There seems to be any number of amounts, Mr. Speaker. It's a very interesting little scam the Labor Party's running here, and I think the public deserve to see it.
The member knows that's out of order. I just want to, like, it's up to the House, really. And I'm on my feet, so I don't need a commentary. It's up to the House. Be careful. All I say is that you're not opening yourselves up, when I say all parties up, to have emails tabled in the House for the same purpose. Point of order. Well, you can speak to this.
Mr. Speaker, the member can't accuse another party of being engaged in a scam, no matter how superior his knowledge on the topic is.
So what do you suggest I do about that? And then I'll ask the opposition what they... No, we'll just deal with this issue first, because otherwise we're becoming to have multiple issues on top of the original issues. So I'm going to deal with this one first, and I'll deal with that one, that breach right there as well. So that's one, two, three, four. I'm dealing with number one first, okay? Everyone clear about that? Good.
Leave. Can I seek leave?
No, yes, I'm seeking leave. I'm about to put the leave. Leave has been sought for the purpose of tabling an email. Is there any objection? There is none. It may be dealt with. Issue number two. Chris Bishop will stand, withdraw, and apologise for the the statement he made that was out of order.
Speaking to the ruling, point of order. What was out of order about what I said? What was out of order about it?
I've just made a ruling that you will withdraw and apologise for making the statement that you made. You know which one?
Well, I withdraw and apologise. Point of order.
I'll deal with the next. My next ruling. Ruling number two, the Honourable Chris Hipkins will stand, withdraw and apologise.
I withdraw and apologise.
Thank you. And number four, Nicola Willis will stand, withdraw and apologise.
I stand, withdraw and apologise.
And that was for interrupting me while I was making a ruling on my feet. Right, are there any more points of order? Point of order, Nicola Willis.
Point of order. I seek your clarification, Mr Speaker.
No clarifications. There is no such thing of seeking a point of order. You either seek a point of order or not.
Point of order.
Point of order. What is it?
I understand that the word scam has been questioned.
No, you can deal with that at another time. There are ways to deal with that. That is not the way to do it. Do you have further supplementaries? We come to question number five in the name of Chloe Swarbrick.
Mr Speaker, to the Minister of Education, does he agree with the Prime Minister's statement that, quote, education is the greatest enabler in society, end quote? If so, has he seen the People's Inquiry into Student Wellbeing, which found thousands of tertiary students are living in poverty?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr Speaker, yes and yes, although I won't claim to have read it from cover to cover.
Supplementary. Is he concerned at our inquiry finding that 64% of students sacrifice time in class in order to work? And if so, does he think that that demonstrates a barrier-free access to education?
Mr Speaker, I am concerned if students are working overly long hours that are preventing them from study. I'm not concerned that students are necessarily working. That's always been the case. Students have often worked whilst they've been studying. But where students are working over and above what would be a reasonable number of hours to work and study at the same time, yes, that is a concern.
Does he think it's a barrier to education that students pay, on average, 56% of their income towards their rent and also have some of the most insecure, rundown housing in the country, with many reporting damp, cold and mould?
Mr Speaker, I absolutely accept that the state of some student accommodation has not been what it should be. We've been working hard to address that. I don't think that work is finished yet. I think we've still got more work to do to make sure students are living in a higher standard of accommodation than they have been. I would note that it has always been the case that, compared to others, students, the proportion of students' income that goes towards accommodation does tend to be higher for the period that they're studying. That's not new. That is a long-term situation, and you'll find that situation is the same almost everywhere else in the world.
Is he concerned by the finding that two-thirds of students don't have enough money for food, healthcare, bills or other basics? And if so, will he make student allowance universal and raise it so that students have enough support to eat while studying?
Mr Speaker, I am of course concerned if students are finding the cost of living is biting for them, as I am concerned for other New Zealanders who are finding themselves in that situation as well. We have not made a commitment to a universal student allowance because there are significant financial pressures on the New Zealand taxpayer at the moment, and we're not in a position to do that.
Why have no tertiary institutions fully implemented the Pastoral Care Code, which came into effect 8 months ago?
Mr Speaker, that is ultimately a question for them and for the code administrator, which, as the member will be aware, is the New Zealand Qualifications Authority. I do know that NZQA is working closely with Universities New Zealand. Universities New Zealand have undertaken a gap analysis to identify the areas where they still need to make sure they're fully complying with the code. NZQA has been working with them to make sure they're doing that.
Does he agree with the statement of former FUSA President Chris Hipkins that if, quote, the government are serious about providing tertiary education opportunity to all New Zealanders, then urgent attention will need to be given to bringing down tuition fees and boosting financial support for all students, end quote? And if so, does he think that the results of this survey show that he and the government is doing enough to support students now?
Mr Speaker, yes, I do agree with that far-sighted and visionary quote that the member just mentioned. And in fact, I have, throughout my working life, continued to be dedicated to ensuring that we get a better deal for students. And if you look right the way across the term of this Labor government, and in fact the one that came before it, we have continued to seek to remove the financial barriers that students face.
Well, we come to question number six in the name of Taumati Coffee.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Māori Development and asks, what recent reports has the Minister seen on the Māori economy?
Mr Speaker. The Honourable Willie Jackson.
Mr Speaker, I recently launched Te Mata Pairo 2020, which is Te Puni Kōkiri's published research on Māori business. The latest research identified 23,300 Māori-owned businesses, representing 8.8% of all businesses that there is data for in New Zealand for the year ending March 2020. This compares with about 10,200 Māori-owned businesses in the earlier Te Mata Pairo 2019 report. The research also identified 38,200 Māori sole traders, representing 14.7% of all sole traders.
To the Minister, according to the research, what was the share of Māori-owned businesses with wahine owners?
Mr Speaker, very encouraging results here. 39% of Māori-owned businesses had women, had wahine Māori involved as an active shareholder, compared to 1% of non-Māori-owned businesses. Māori-owned businesses were more diverse, with 61% having at least one female owner of any ethnicity, compared to 53% of non-Māori-owned businesses. Regardless of ethnicity, Māori-owned businesses were more likely to have women, both Māori and non-Māori, as active shareholders.
Were Māori-owned businesses with wahine owners more likely to employ Māori?
Mr Speaker, overall, Māori-owned businesses employ a higher percentage of Māori than non-Māori-owned businesses. When wahine Māori were involved as shareholders, this difference was amplified. In non-Māori-owned businesses, Māori represent 14% of the workforce, but in Māori-owned businesses with wahine Māori owners, Māori comprise 43% of the workforce. These results are very encouraging for Māori women, Mr Speaker, because although Māori women are dragging in some of the statistics, they're really coming to the fore in leadership areas, in the business area, in the tribal area, and it's a really good thing to see, and I'm sure all parties would support that.
To the Minister, what does Te Mata Pairua tell us about the importance of the Māori economy?
Mr Speaker, Te Mata Pairo 2020 highlights the important role Māori-owned businesses play in the economy, the rohe and in communities. This research has identified the importance of wahine Māori talent, as I said earlier, Mr Speaker, in Māori-owned businesses, and demonstrated how significant employers of Māori play an important role in employment in the regions. The new report reflects some encouraging trends in the wider contribution made by many Māori-owned businesses. Sharpening our understanding of the scale and makeup of the Māori economy will help us identify the untapped opportunities and need. In turn, this will help improve equitable outcomes for Māori and enable whānau to thrive.
Question number seven in the name of Brooke Van Velder.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Housing and reads as follows. How many Kiwi Build houses were built in June 2022, if any, and was this more or less than the number of Kiwi Build houses built in January 2022?
Kia ora, Mr Speaker. So far, 1,380 New Zealand families are in Kiwi Build homes and 1,223 homes are currently under construction. In the 2 months the member mentioned, as is publicly available on the housing dashboard, zero and the same.
Supplementary. Does she stand by her statement, quote, I note that January is always the quietest month in the building sector. If so, how does she reconcile that with zero new Kiwi Build homes being built in June?
Mr. Speaker, I reconcile that with the fact that 2021 we're in Auckland had a number of lockdown periods. This in turn had an impact on building projects, particularly groundworks getting underway, which typically start in June. I do note of the 1,200 odd that are currently under construction that we are expected to see some of those flow through more towards the end of this year, which is consistent with the timeline that I've just sketched out.
Supplementary. Does she stand by her statement that, quote, KiwiBuild hasn't delivered the numbers we initially set out to do? And did she mean zero new homes built in June or one new home being built in April?
Mr. Speaker, when we reset KiwiBuild back in 2019, that what we said is that we would build as many homes as quickly as we could. That so far we have over 1,300 people that are living in KiwiBuild homes, a further 1,200 odd homes that are under construction. But I do note and point, Mr. Speaker, to the fact that when we made the adjustments to the KiwiBuild price caps and income caps, that only a matter of 2 hours after we made that announcement, that NZMS, the developer financer, immediately made $600 million available for KiwiBuild projects, they realised that in the face of strong market headwinds, that actually a government-backed lever to de-risk projects is exactly what is required to ensure we don't see a post-GFC-type collapse of the housing market.
Supplementary. How can the Minister guarantee that KiwiBuild will be able to deliver the 1,454 homes currently in the pipeline for delivery between 2022 and 2026 when it couldn't deliver any homes for the months of January and June?
Mr. Speaker, as I've outlined in previous answers to the member, that obviously the shutdown in Auckland has last year, COVID lockdowns in Auckland, had flown on impacts to construction projects, not just KiwiBuild projects. I think if the member was to talk to anybody in the construction industry, you'd see that there have been significant delays. The homes, the 1,223 homes, are already currently under construction. And I think that's one of the critical things, that we do not announce KiwiBuild homes till they are, already have financing approved for them and they are under construction. I think reasons obvious to every member in this House, we are conservative with our forecasts on KiwiBuild.
Supplementary. When will the government drop KiwiBuild and adopt ACT's policy of sharing GST from new builds with consent-issuing local councils, allowing them to develop the vital infrastructure needed for more housing development?
Mr. Speaker, as I've outlined to the member in an answer to a previous question, we won't be dropping a government underwrite to de-risk properties in the face of significant market headwinds. I pointed to the fact that only a couple of hours after we raised the income and price caps for KiwiBuild, that we saw a NZMS, a developer financer, come out and announce $600 million worth of funding that would be made available to developers for KiwiBuild projects because of that de-risking element. I see a number of flaws in the GST proposal from the ACT Party. Many of them, if you were to refund the whole GST back on, an $800,000 house, that would be refunding $120,000 back to a council, which is way more than what, if we look, for example, to the Infrastructure Acceleration Fund, some of the projects that we have funded that have been as little as $6,000 per dwelling that have gone for the infrastructural upgrades required to make them. I think the ACT proposal is untargeted. There is no guarantee that we will see houses, and actually I think it is paying too much per dwelling.
We come to question number 8 in the name of the Honourable Louise Upston.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and Employment and asks, does she agree with the Prime Minister that, quote, it does matter to us as a Labor government that we have people in the dignity of work, unquote? If so, why are over 50,000 more people receiving the job seeker support as at June 2022 quarter compared to the September 2017 quarter?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Willie Jackson.
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, as she said yesterday, she agrees with absolutely with the Prime Minister. What we are seeing is record numbers of people moving off job seeker and into work. In the year ending June 2022, 95,583 people on JobSeeker exited into work. This is a 62% increase in the same period in 2017. Mr Speaker, this is because of this government's successful investments in employment programs. For example, today we announced that our effective employment and training program, Mana in Mahi, has supported over 5,000 participants. Magnificent, really. Great work from this government. Mr Speaker, that is what it looks like when a government, Mr Speaker, is successful at getting people back into the dignity of work.
Supplementary. Can she explain why, when businesses around New Zealand are crying out for workers, the number of 18 to 24-year-olds on the JobSeeker benefit has increased by 49% under her watch?
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, exit into work have been at record levels for the past 2 years. In the year ending June 2022, 113,427 people have exited into work. That is a 44% increase, Mr Goldsmith, from the same time in 2017. Some people, they have complex lives. That means they might need extra help. It's not always easy. For example, sometimes there's a lack of suitable housing. There are transport difficulties. They have physical requirements. They need some attention. They need some support. They need some investment. Investment they never got for 9 years under a National Party government. That's why we're breaking down barriers, Mr Speaker, to work by, build more houses, invest in businesses, support people to get a driver's licence. We're restating the training incentive allowance so people can upskill. And we're working with this people. This is not a punitive government, Mr Speaker. It's a government that works with the community, in tandem with the community. And I'm proud to work with our minister in supporting our different communities.
Why, when MSD has hired an additional 2,300 staff under this government, are more people on welfare for longer?
Mr Speaker, don't accept that. We don't accept that position. We're getting more and more people into employment and training. 5,091 placements through Mana and Mahi since 2018, despite criticism from the other side about Mana and Mahi, who thought that the program was going to collapse and fall over. 3,869 young people have been supported into employment, educational training, or training through He Potamarangatahi. Mr Speaker, I was lucky enough to have been Employment Minister during this time, and I saw firsthand how targeted programs help these people. Our Minister Carmel Cipollone has taken up the challenge and is doing brilliant work. And today, with our Prime Minister, was a magnificent announcement with regards to Mana and Mahi, and I would ask the opposition to think about that.
Supplementary. Why did her Mana and Mahi press release saying 75% of participants who had been on benefit for two or more consecutive years hadn't gone back on to benefit, omit the fact that of the 75%, only 5% had been on benefit for 2 years or more?
Well, Mr Speaker, you'll have to take that up with the Minister when she comes back. All I know, Mr Speaker, is Mana and Mahi has been an overwhelming success, and I have been... I'll say today, very humbly, I gave Mana and Mahi the name. So I gave that the name, and I was very proud to give it the name. And the great work has continued with the Minister and the Prime Minister. And the opposition would have been calling it working for the dole. We talk about dignity and work. We talk about there is Mana and Mahi. Even if you're cleaning the kitchen at the local marae, that's all part of dignity and looking after people, something that opposition forgot for 9 years.
should people on the job seeker benefit who decline formal job offers face sanctions?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, we've been very good in the sanctions area. We've actually there hasn't been a lot of changes in terms of work related sanctions under this government. What the change has been the change of attitude. That's the change. We are not a punitive government. This is a kind government. Our Prime Minister always talks about kindness, not punishing people who have a few problems in their lives. Jerry Brownlee and the rest of the opposition need to learn about aroha and kindness and talk with our Prime Minister. Shame on you.
Get up. Order. We come to question number 10 in the name of Erica Stanford. Oh, sorry. Sorry, I've jumped ahead. Sorry, question number 9 in the name of Shannon Halbert.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question to the Associate Minister of Health. What announcement has the government recently made about HIV?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Dr. Aisha Viru.
On Saturday, the Prime Minister and I launched the HIV Action Plan for consultation alongside $18 million of funding for the work. The HIV Action Plan outlines a plan to eliminate HIV transmission in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and ensure that people living with HIV enjoy lives, healthy lives that are free from stigma and discrimination. HIV is a preventable infection, and Aotearoa, New Zealand is in a strong position to drastically reduce case numbers and eliminate HIV transmission by 2032. This is an ambitious but achievable aim.
Supplementary. How will the additional funding support the plan to eliminate HIV transmission?
Mr. Speaker, the $18 million for over 4 years from Budget 2022 for the HIV Action Plan gives us a very strong start towards elimination of HIV. The Draft Action Plan outlines 4 areas where we need to focus. Surveillance systems to understand risk factors in populations, prevention and health promotion, including greater use of PrEP enabled by the recent Pharm Act decision to widen eligibility criteria, better access to testing and to care, and support for people living with HIV, including addressing stigma and discrimination.
How will the HIV Action Plan deliver against government objectives?
Mr. Speaker, this government is committed to support our diversity and creating a New Zealand where all people feel safe, have equal access to opportunities and do not experience discrimination. Yet one third of people living with HIV have experienced stigma and discrimination as a result of their diagnosis. To eliminate HIV, we need to fight this by targeting the disease, not the individual. We will do this with our tertiary obligations at the centre of our response to HIV and with a focus on human rights. This initiative builds on the government's wider work to support rainbow communities, like banning conversion therapy or making the health system more responsive to transgender people.
Well done. And now question number 10, in the name of Erica Stanford.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Immigration, does he stand by the former minister's target of 10 working days for job checks for accredited employer work visas? If so, can he confirm that only 20% have been processed in that time frame?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Dr. David Clark.
On behalf of the Minister of Immigration, in response to the first part of the question, yes, I acknowledge there have been some initial issues raised by employers in the job check process, which are being identified and ironed out as a priority. But on the whole, the process is working as intended. To date, 3,807 job check applications have been received and 1,179 have been approved, totaling 8,868 positions. Job check processing times are showing improvement, increasing to 32% being completed within the expected timeframe. I continue to regularly reinforce my expectations that processing times are met and that processing issues are identified and resolved as quickly as possible.
If, as he says, the visa is working as intended, can he confirm that as of Thursday last week, only one accredited employer work visa had been approved around 4 weeks after applications opened, according to a Key Messages update from Immigration New Zealand?
Mr. Speaker, I have an update for the member, but I do think the context here is really important. To date, 3,807 job check applications have been received and 1,179 have been approved, meaning that 8,868 positions are able to be recruited for now, and that is quite some progress. The member will know, of course, that COVID has presented a challenge in the immigration and New Zealand workforce as well. And also the further context that the visa application stage has only been working, has only been open for 24 days, and with a 20-day working day processing timeframe, we're early days in the program. They're working with employers to try and facilitate that process where applications are not meeting expectations. They're working with employers, and that takes extra time. And we would expect to see numbers increase over the coming weeks. So 4 days past that initial deadline, the number's up to seven, and I'd expect to see that continue to grow.
Well done. Is the reason so few employer-accredited work visas have been submitted and approved because, as of last week Thursday, Immigration New Zealand had only processed 14% of the job check applications that they received since the 20th of June, which are required before a migrant can apply for a work visa?
Mr. Speaker, as I've said to the member, the system is showing improvement. We are seeing each stage as it comes in new. These are new processes. And I think it's absolutely right that Immigration New Zealand should be working with employers where the applications are not up to scratch to work with the employers. This is a new process, and it's completely understandable if they haven't got it right in some cases first time. That will have a long-term benefit for New Zealand and for those employers, and I think we should be congratulating them on the work that they're doing.
Is he seriously suggesting that employers are the reason that only seven employer-accredited work visas have been approved in nearly 4 weeks?
I refer the member to my previous answers. I did not say it in that way, and I think the member is seeking to misrepresent what I've been saying. Unfortunate and disingenuous. I want to thank employers who are working in the system hard to make it work, and I want to thank Immigration New Zealand for making this new system work for the benefit of all of us.
What does he say to Sean Wood of Creative Kitchens in Tauranga, who has turned down over $100,000 of work yesterday because his job check applications have not been processed 7 weeks after he applied, while three skilled employees sit in the UK waiting to apply for a work visa to come to New Zealand and join his team?
Mr. Speaker, obviously on behalf of the Minister, while I won't speak to individual applications, I do understand that the issue raised by Mr. Wood relates to the checking of individual employment contracts. It is good practice to carry out basic checks of employment contracts, ensuring that the employment contracts pass the sniff test.
That's right.
Question number 11 in the name of Changi Utikere.
My question is to the Associate Minister of Education, Pacific Peoples. What recent work has the government done to enhance Pacific languages and bilingual learning in Aotearoa?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Opetal Williams-Seal.
Me taki mata e te wa'a tuatua. As we celebrate te petoma o te reo Māori Koki Airani, I look to the Cook Islands proverb which says, E amarai tō te waka. The waka cannot sail the ocean without the ama to give it balance, working together to carry us on all that waka across the moana to new horizons. This Cook Islands proverb underpins the work of this government and the Pacific Languages Strategy. It paints the picture of sailing together, bound together, and one outrigger providing balance to the other, describing the work done by government to support Pacific languages in Aotearoa with the Ministry of Education, working alongside with the Ministry of Pacific Peoples, Pacific Educators and Learners, and Pacific Communities, and why this government in Budget 2022 has invested $13 million to support the growth of the Pacific Bilingual and Immersion Schooling workforce and the retention of the current workforce.
Va'atuatua, how is the government supporting Pacific languages and bilingual teaching in schools?
Me taki mātai te wa'an tuatua. Last Sunday, I opened Te Petoma o Te Reo Māori Koki Arini, the Cook Islands Language Week 22, at the Enua Manu Hall in Mangere. There I spoke of the challenges for the Cook Islands language classified as vulnerable by UNESCO, with 9% of Cook Islands people speaking the language in Aotearoa, which is why E Petoma o Te Reo Māori Koki Arini and the Pacific Language Weeks are essential to raise awareness and breathe life into the mataora of Te Reo Māori Koki Arini, its people and their identity as Cook Islanders across Aotearoa New Zealand and the vast blue Pacific continent. Our 9 Pacific Language Weeks will allow our Pacific people to walk in two worlds and demonstrates how this government is building cultural capacity and bilingualism and for the next generation of Pacific learners.
Va'atuatua, what do educators say about having these Pacific resources available for their students?
Me taki mātou te va'atuatua. A 2019 report on Pacific bilingual education highlighted that the New Zealand school roll is more ethnically diverse than it has ever been, and there are now more Pacific students at school when compared with the Pacific population in Aotearoa. As of 2018, about 79,000 students identified themselves as Pacific, or nearly 11% of the national school roll. A bilingual teacher in that same 2019 report captured the work of government well when they said, referring to Pacific languages and cultures, and I quote, "If you know from where you come, there is no limit to where you can go. If learners can connect and know who they are and celebrate those things that make them unique, then we have a better chance to raise the achievement levels," referring to Pacific language skills and cultural intelligence.
Question number 12 is in the name of Penny Simmons.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Education and asks, does Te Pūkenga have a detailed plan focused on the underlying financial issues facing some of its subsidiaries, and if not, why not?
The Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Mr. Speaker, I'm advised that Te Pūkenga has a program of action to reduce the deficit and, of course, addressing the underlying financial viability of the vocational education sector is the purpose of the reform program.
Supplementary. Does the Minister consider it as good practice that the financial sustainability of the Te Pūkenga operating model being consulted on from 15 August has not yet been determined?
Mr. Speaker, you generally determine something before you start to consult on it.
Thank you. Does the Minister think it is a fair tool or a blunt tool for Head Office of Te Pūkenga to ask each subsidiary polytechnic for a 3% saving when some polytechnics will already be operating more efficiently than others?
Mr. Speaker, that is of course a matter for Te Pūkenga as to how it achieves financial viability and returns to surplus. I would note that almost all of the subsidiaries have experienced a decline in enrolments and particularly a decline in international students, such that even those that were previously doing better financially are not in that same position now.
Supplementary. What concerns, if any, does the Minister have with the Head Office of Te Pūkenga asking subsidiary polytechnics to use high staff turnover as a cost-saving approach? And isn't this approach high risk with the potential to leave polytechnics without essential key skills?
Mr. Speaker, I reject the assertion in the member's question. It's not unusual for an organisation that is facing a significant deficit to effectively put in place a hiring freeze, which is what Te Pūkenga has done.
Supplementary. Has the Minister signed off on Te Pūkenga paying for a chief executive, an acting chief executive, and an acting chief executive when the acting chief executive travels overseas next month, bearing in mind that the organisation is seeking to claw back a $110 million forecast deficit?
Mr. Speaker, I think that's a somewhat cheap question, as the member is well aware, because she was told at the Select Committee yesterday the acting chief executive took on the role on the basis that he would take leave to attend the the wedding of one of his children in the UK. I think attacking him for doing so when he was very clear when he took on the role that that's what he was going to do is pretty cheap.
That concludes oral questions.